Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Egyptians vote in a two-day presidential election. South African runner Oscar Pistorius begins psychological testing. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Egyptians are voting in a two-day presidential election. Former Egyptian army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who ousted the elected Islamist leader Mohamed Morsi, is widely expected to win. He is only facing one opponent, a leftist politician who finished third in the last election. For more on this story, take a look at our website, voanews.com. The ongoing Ebola outbreak in West Africa has claimed its first deaths in Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization says, according to preliminary field information, five people have died from the disease in the town of Koindu. With the latest deaths, the disease has killed a total of 179 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. South African runner Oscar Pistorius arrived at a hospital today to begin psychiatric tests as ordered by the judge at his murder trial. The judge called for the tests after a psychiatrist testified that Pistorius has an anxiety disorder which could have contributed to the fatal shooting of his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. The Associated Press is reporting that South Africa is looking for support from neighboring countries in a bid to host the 2022 Commonwealth Games. That would bring the competition to Africa for the first time and could open the way for staging the Olympics in Africa. The AFP News Service says a last-minute agreement has at least temporarily saved controversial South African politician Julius Malema from losing his seat in Parliament. Malema is facing charges that he failed to pay his taxes. His lawyer says the lawmaker has been granted an extension. Malema also faces corruption charges. AFP reports that the United Nations has demanded that Congo-Brazzaville stop forcibly returning people to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN says Congo-Brazzaville's push to expel illegal foreign workers has resulted in the deportation of more than 130,000 DRC nationals since April 4th. The UN says that creates a humanitarian crisis. The Associated Press says a Libyan journalist known for his criticism of Islamists has been shot and killed in the city of Benghazi. Mufta Abu Zaid was the chief editor of Burnick newspaper. The report says he was attacked while driving his car down a main street in the city. The AFP news agency says the United States government is urging calm in Malawi as that nation awaits the results of last week's election. A State Department spokeswoman asked Malawians to avoid violence and to resolve controversies over the election in accordance with the law. Malawi's Electoral Commission, president, and political parties are involved in a number of suits and countersuits due to reports of voting irregularities. Exit polls across the European Union show surprising strong wins for so-called Eurosceptics in the European Parliament elections. France's prime minister calls the results an earthquake for Europe and France, where Marine Le Pen's National Front Party has the outright victory. Nationalist parties are expected also to win in Denmark and Britain. The leader of the United Kingdom Independent Party, UKIP, Nigel Farage, hailed advances made by his group.
Well, my dream's become a reality. And despite the onslaught we faced over the last few weeks, as if the whole world was against us, the British public have stood firm, they've backed UKIP, and we've won a national election.
In Greece, a leftist coalition is poised to win. Greek leftists strongly opposed the government's economic austerity program and the terms of an EU bailout. Thailand's military chief and coup leader, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, says the country's king has formally endorsed his role as head of the military council that runs the country. In a televised press briefing today, the general said he would have no choice but to use force if political protests flare up again. He said he aims for an election as soon as possible, but gave no time frame for a vote. Heavy fighting reported in eastern Ukraine today. Government forces are battling pro-Russian separatists who seized parts of the main airport in the city of Donetsk. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Over 400,000 Egyptian police and army soldiers have deployed Monday for the start of a two-day presidential election. More than 14,000 judges are overseeing the vote at polling stations across the country. Several hundred European Union and African Union observers are also monitoring the vote.
That's Edward Uranian reporting from Cairo. Details next. Also in the news, Cameroon and Chad have sent 1,000 troops to their borders with Nigeria to fight the Islamist group Boko Haram. And the Bread for the World Institute says progress is being made against world hunger. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ivory Coast, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead in African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, over 400,000 Egyptian police and army soldiers have deployed today for the start of a two-day presidential election. More than 14,000 judges are overseeing the vote at polling stations across the country. Several hundred European Union and African Union observers are also monitoring the vote, as Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Helicopters hovered over parts of the Egyptian capital, Cairo, early Monday as voting in the two-day presidential election got underway. Security was tight in many neighborhoods. Police blocked off streets and parts of city blocks to protect voters at polling stations. Sky News Arabia reported that young men from the now-banned Muslim Brotherhood group were arrested in Manufia province north of Cairo after they resorted to violence to disrupt the election. Police denied initial reports that Muslim Brotherhood supporters threw a homemade bomb in front of a church in the town of Bani Suif, south of Cairo. Lines formed in front of many polling stations in Cairo as voters took time off from work to cast their ballots. Women waving Egyptian flags cheered and ululated in front of one polling station as others waved pictures of former Defense Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who was favored to win the election. Turnout in other major cities, including Assyut, Suez, Alexandria, and Ismailia, appeared fairly heavy as Egyptian TV correspondents interviewed voters in long lines in front of some polling stations. 54 million Egyptians are eligible to vote out of a population of nearly 90 million. Voters appeared to stay away from the polls in several key Muslim Brotherhood strongholds, including Sharqiya province north of Cairo. The Muslim Brotherhood has called on its supporters to boycott the election and to hold protests instead. Sharqiya is home to ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. Supporters clamored and cheered as presidential favorite Abdel Fattah al-Sisi cast his vote at a polling station near his home in a Cairo suburb. Young men crowded around him as he stopped to shake hands and discuss his vision for the future of the country. He tells Egyptians to write their own history and their own future because, he says, the world is watching them. With this election, he argues, Egyptians will determine their destiny. With God's help, he insists, Egypt will have a glorious future. Rival candidate Hamdine Sabahi, who came in third place in Egypt's 2012 presidential vote, insisted that he was running since it was in the best interest of his country and that he hoped to build a coalition in parliament in upcoming elections. He says that whatever happens, if he wins the election or he loses it, he will have played a positive role for his country. He insists that he and his allies are working for social justice, democracy, and independence for Egypt, and that he hopes to later win seats in parliament. Prime Minister Ibrahim Mehleb told Egyptian TV that he was grateful to the police for keeping order, and he thanked voters, especially young people, for turning out. He says that it's refreshing to see a heavy turnout of young people because they are the ones who will most profit from a better future for the country. He adds that everyone must pave the way for a brighter future for coming generations. For his part, acting President Adli Mansour, who will hand over the reins of the country to the winner of the election, told State TV that the two-day presidential vote is a step towards rebuilding Egypt after a long period of turmoil. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Media reports say Saudi Arabia has arrested 9 university professors for alleged ties to the banned Muslim Brotherhood. 2 of the professors are Saudis and the rest are from neighboring countries. The Saudi government considers the Brotherhood a terror group. Saudi Arabia's neighborhood, the United Arab Emirates, is also cracking down on those believed to be members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Cameroon and Chad have sent 1,000 troops to their borders with Nigeria to fight the Islamist group Boko Haram. The troops were deployed shortly after leaders from the 2 countries met in Yaoundé and declared war against the violent group. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
These are soldiers of Cameroon's Rapid Intervention Battalion singing in excitement as they leave Yaoundé, capital of the West African country, for the border with Nigeria. They headed out barely a day after Presidents Idriss Déby of Chad and Paul Biya of Cameroon announced they are waging war on Boko Haram. Colonel Didier Bajek, spokesperson of the Cameroon military, told VOA that the soldiers will work with the local people to find out who members of the violent group are, since the soldiers are aware they will be fighting an enemy that uses unconventional tactics.
We have occupied the field so that the response should be more spontaneous. I want to say that we need a total cooperation from the public. This will encourage us in the field to know exactly that people are thinking about us and are supporting their defense forces. We especially await information from the population.
Before the soldiers left, Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Bengo, met with Chad's minister of national defense, Benindo Tatola, in Yaoundé. Ngo said Chad had also deployed troops to work together with Cameroonian forces on the borders with Nigeria. He also said troops from the 2 countries will cross into Nigeria and fight Boko Haram in collaboration with Nigerian forces. Nigeria has often accused Cameroon of not doing enough to fight Boko Haram, even though the terrorist group frequently crosses into Cameroonian territory. Cameroon has been attacked several times by Boko Haram. Earlier this month, rebels from the violent group attacked a military post in Kuseri, far north Cameroon, and freed one of their members being held there. They also attacked the locality of Waza in north Cameroon and stole 12 vehicles, kidnapped 10 Chinese workers, and killed a Cameroonian soldier. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
A newspaper editor was reported shot dead in Libya's eastern city of Benghazi today. AFP says Mafta Bouzid was the editor of the weekly newspaper Burnik. Bouzid was a frequent critic of extremist militias in the city and had received death threats. He also supported the military offensive launched this month against those militias led by renegade general Khalifa Haftar. The watchdog group Reporters Without Borders says it is deeply concerned about the safety of journalists in Libya, adding they are yet again targets of violence. You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Over 400,000 Egyptian police and army soldiers have deployed today for the start of a two-day presidential election. Cameroon and Chad have sent 1,000 troops to their borders with Nigeria to fight the Islamist group Boko Haram. And the Bread for the World Institute says progress is being made against world hunger. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The UN says hunger kills more people every year than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. Despite progress since 1990, it's estimated more than 840 million people still do not have enough to eat. Nevertheless, the director of the Bread for the World Institute says recent efforts can bring a dramatic improvement. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Asma Latif says the opportunity exists to tackle hunger on a sustained basis and not just address emergency situations.
Well, I think we're in a good space right now. I think for the first time in human history, we have the prospect of ending global hunger within a generation by 2030.
The Bread for the World Institute is a Christian-based organization providing strategies to end world hunger. Latif says achieving the potential to ensure food security has been a joint effort.
This has been due to a lot of deliberate work on the part of governments around the world, particularly the governments of countries that are hardest hit by hunger, but also by the support of the United States and the leadership of the United States.
The 1996 UN World Food Summit issued the Rome Declaration. It called for reducing by half the number of chronically undernourished people by 2015. However, Latif says at the time, there was no unified strategy as to how to do that.
There was a great focus on industrialization. I think people felt that if you helped countries develop and have economic growth, that would address hunger as well. And so you did find, actually, a huge reduction in extreme poverty around the world. But that didn't translate into necessarily at the same pace a reduction in hunger.
She says the focus on how to fight hunger changed during the 2008 food security crisis, as high prices and shortages affected many countries.
It was the global response that came as a result of that food price crisis. It was a real wake-up call. Riots around the world as people were really struggling to be able to afford food, and prices of basic commodities had just skyrocketed. That got the attention of a lot of policymakers, including U.S. leaders at the time. And since then, the Obama administration has really made food security and hunger a priority within global development programs and has galvanized global attention to this issue.
Leaders realized that food security was a threat to national security. Latif says policies developed during the food crisis have made a difference.
You know, we're very close to achieving the Millennium Development Goal of halving hunger by 2015. We won't make that target because it's next year and because of the food price crisis. But the effort that's been put in over the last few years really puts us on track.
The Bread for the World Institute director says currently enough food is being produced to feed everyone on the planet. The problem, she says, is that many people cannot afford it or gain access to it. And a lot of food is wasted every year by poor harvesting and inadequate storage and transportation. It's estimated the world population will grow from about 7 billion to 9 billion by 2050. As a result, the emphasis in recent years has been on investing in smallholder farms and making them much more efficient.
With growing population, as well as with the impact of climate change on food security, there will be a need to really become more innovative and make use of all the available arable land and get more out of the land than we currently do. In Africa, a lot of the land is not being used to its full potential.
Lateef praises the U.S. government's recent Feed the Future Progress Report, saying it links livelihoods to smallholder farm investments. She calls on the U.S. and others to ensure those investments are made over the long term. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Refugee Agency says hundreds of refugees in Jordan and Syria are being denied cancer treatment because of lack of funds. Lisa Schlein has the story from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the number of refugees with cancer is overwhelming health systems in Jordan and Syria. UNHCR's top medical expert, Paul Spiegel, tells VOA decisions on who gets treatment and who does not are made on the basis of cost. He says helping the largest number of people with the limited amount of money on hand is usually the determining factor.
For the colleagues themselves that have to deal with this, it is extremely, extremely difficult. And we sometimes try to help them, to give them counseling. We have a standard operating procedure that can be shared with both the doctors and the refugees to say, this is what happens. And we do this in order to help the most amount of people. But no matter which way you look at it, it's a horrible experience.
A new UNHCR study tracks refugee cancer cases in Jordan and Syria from 2009 to 2012. It says the number of cases in the region is rising because there are more refugees and more people fleeing middle-income countries such as Syria. The UNHCR has set up an exceptional care committee which decides whether to fund expensive treatments. The study finds the most common form of cancer among refugees is breast cancer, accounting for almost one quarter of all applications in Jordan. Of 511 cancer cases, Dr. Spiegel says fewer than half were approved for treatment between 2010 and 2012. He says treatment is usually denied to patients with little chance of recovery.
So that the treatment would not actually prolong the life or prolong for a very short period of time, 6 months, and would be very expensive, to someone like this would be denied. Because, again, I know it sounds heartless and it's a very difficult decision, but with a limited amount of money, we can ensure that we can treat people where we can hopefully cure the cancer, or at least what's called a functional cure, so that they will have at least 5 more years and hopefully a lifetime.
Dr. Spiegel notes many hospitals in Syria have been destroyed or closed by conflict. He says it is likely many Syrians with serious health problems choose to leave the country more in hopes of getting treated for their illnesses than out of security concerns. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In South Africa, Olympic athlete and accused murderer Oscar Pistorius arrived today at a government psychiatric hospital. He's beginning a court-ordered mental evaluation that could last up to 30 days. A psychiatrist had testified that Pistorius suffers from an anxiety disorder, which may have contributed to the fatal shooting of his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, at his home in February. Pistorius will be evaluated on an outpatient basis. Since he is free on bail, he'll be allowed to return home each day. The trial has been postponed until June 30th. There is a new warning today about climate change. The World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, says carbon dioxide levels throughout the Northern Hemisphere have reached 400 parts per million. It says that the first time that's happened in human history, up 40% since the widespread use of fossil fuels began during the Industrial Revolution. The WMO calls it an ominous threshold and says the high carbon dioxide levels are spreading towards the Southern Hemisphere. Carbon dioxide helps trap heat in the atmosphere, contributing to rising temperatures. Experts say that raises the risks of heat waves, droughts, and higher sea levels. President Barack Obama has paid tribute to America's war dead as the United States today marked the annual Memorial Day holiday. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Washington.
Hours after completing a whirlwind trip to visit U.S. troops in Afghanistan, President Barack Obama laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery just across the Potomac River from Washington. Moments later, Mr. Obama noted the ultimate sacrifices made by generations of Americans from the nation's founding to the present day.
Everything that we hold precious in this country was made possible by Americans who gave their all. And because of them, our nation is stronger, safer, and will always remain a shining beacon of freedom for the rest of the world.
The president paid special tribute to the widow of a soldier who went missing during the Korean War and who waited more than 60 years for her husband's remains to be found and returned for burial in the United States. Mr. Obama noted that 2014 marks the final year of combat for American forces in Afghanistan and the 150th anniversary of the founding of Arlington National Cemetery. Next month marks 70 years since U.S. troops stormed the beaches at Normandy, France during World War II. While paying tribute to fallen soldiers, Mr. Obama pledged to surmount delays and other problems plaguing the government health care provider for military veterans.
As we've been reminded in recent days, we must do more to keep faith with our veterans and their families and ensure they get the care and benefits and opportunities that they've earned and that they deserve.
A day of rest and remembrance for many, with parades in towns and cities across the nation, the Memorial Day holiday began in the 1860s to honor America's Civil War dead. After World War I, it was expanded to include all who perished in military service. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Over 400,000 Egyptian police and army soldiers have deployed today for the start of a two-day presidential election. Cameroon and Chad have sent 1,000 troops to their borders with Nigeria to fight the Islamist group Boko Haram. And the UN says hunger kills more people every year than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. Coming up, music from Ivory Coast, and in our feature segment, we look into the conflict going on in South Sudan, which has prompted a humanitarian crisis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with World Cup football news.
Yehias, we're now 17 days away until the kickoff of the Football World Cup in Brazil. Some soccer-licious World Cup tidbits now for our VOA football fans. World Cup-bound Australia drew with South Africa Monday night, 1-1 in Sydney, in the last home match for the Socceroos before they depart for Brazil. Both goals came early in the match. Ayanda Potosi put South Africa ahead on a right-footed shot from the left side of the box in the 13th minute. The Aussies equalized only a minute later on a towering header by Tim Cahill. It was his 33rd international goal for the Socceroos, who are in a difficult first-round group in Brazil, along with Chile, the Netherlands, and reigning World Cup champion Spain. The Australians will play Chile June 13th in their first World Cup match in Cuiabá, Brazil. Meanwhile, Spain will train here in Washington next week and play a friendly match before going to Brazil. The Spaniards have chosen Catholic University here in Washington as their training venue from June 3rd to June 5th. The sessions will be closed to the public. On June 7th, Spain will play El Salvador in a friendly match at FedEx Field just outside Washington. Spain's head coach, Vicente Del Bosque, has delayed finalizing his 23-man World Cup squad until closer to FIFA's June 2nd deadline. He wants to buy some time for striker Diego Costa of Atletico Madrid, who aggravated a hamstring injury in Saturday's 4-1 loss to Real Madrid in the UEFA Champions League final in Lisbon, Portugal. Spain will host Bolivia in Sevilla Friday in its first World Cup warm-up match. The Spaniards will play the Netherlands June 13th in Salvador, Brazil, in the opening World Cup match for both teams. It's a rematch of the 2010 World Cup final in South Africa, where the Spaniards beat the Dutch 1-0 in extra time on a goal by Andres Iniesta. Just ahead, our Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, will have more World Cup tidbits for us.
Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky.
That's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, entitled We Are One. As the World Cup approaches, protesters in Brazil seem to have become more energized. On Saturday, hundreds of demonstrators gathered in Sao Paulo in another protest against the World Cup. The Sao Paulo Police Department said on its Twitter page that no violent incidents had been reported and that over 250 protesters took part in the demonstration. After about 2 hours, the protesters marched down nearby streets, chanting, "There will be no World Cup." Protests over increases in bus and subway fares, government corruption, poor public services, and the billions of dollars spent to host the World Cup broke out last year in several cities. Protesters say the money would be better spent on improving Brazil's health, education, security, and infrastructure systems than on the soccer tournaments. Several smaller protest rallies have taken place since then. The month-long tournament starts with the June 12th opener in Sao Paulo. Meanwhile, the 2014 World Cup is the most lucrative and expensive in FIFA history. Record numbers include $35 million in prize money to the winning team's federation, $4 billion in commercial revenue for FIFA, and a $14 billion bill for Brazil. With 3 million tickets available to buy, the 64-match tournament is almost sold out. The financial success, we have it, it is done, FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volke has said, adding that FIFA has never sold so many tickets. Back here in Africa, Ghana, one of the 5 teams built to fly the continent's flag in Brazil, on Friday night gave local fans a glimpse of their firepower with a 6-1 beating of a local select side. Kwesi Appiah's team scored through Christian Atsu, Jordan Ayew, Albert Adoma, and Sule Muntari. The Black Stars coach took the opportunity to have a look at the depth of his squad ahead of its departure to the Netherlands on Saturday night to continue with preparations. The match ended the Black Stars' first phase of preparation for the World Cup. Ahead of the match, Ghana's President John Mahama hosted the national team to a dinner in the capital city of Accra. The president says the Black Stars have the quality to make history by winning the World Cup in Brazil for the first time. He urged the players to put extra effort to make that dream happen. Ghana, which will be making its third straight appearance at the World Cup finals, has been drawn into Group G with 3-time winner Germany, Portugal, and the United States. Ghana will train in the Netherlands until the end of the month and then move to Florida in the United States from June 1st to 9th before traveling to Brazil. In a related development, Cameroon, another of the 5 Brazil-bound African teams, will take on Moldova in a friendly in the capital city of Yaoundé on June 7th as part of its preparations for the World Cup finals. The friendly was initially planned between the Indomitable Lions and the Guatemalan national team, but for unexplained reasons, the match was cancelled. And from the West African nation of Ivory Coast, which is also preparing for the World Cup, comes this bad news that Yaya Toure is receiving treatment in Qatar for an unspecified injury. According to the Ivorian Football Federation, Toure is the only member of the team to miss the start of the World Cup preparations in Dallas on Thursday. The midfielder will only fly to the US next Thursday to join up with his colleagues. Toure has suffered a thigh injury in mid-April, but returned after 2 weeks to help Manchester City secure the Premier League title. Ivory Coast will play 2 friendlies in the United States against Bosnia in St. Louis on May 30th and El Salvador in Dallas on June 4th. The team will arrive in Brazil on June 6th. At the World Cup, the Ivorians have been drawn in Group C against Colombia, Greece, and Japan. Thanks a lot for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Put your flags up in the sky.
When the going gets tough, let's all keep going. One love, one life, one world, one fight, whole world, one night, one place, Brazil. Everybody put your flags in the sky and do what you feel. It's your world, my world, our world today. And we invite the whole world to play. It's your world, my world, our world today. And we invite the whole world to play. En mi mundo, tu mundo, el mundo de nosotros. Invitamos a todo el mundo a jugar con nosotros.
Yeah.
And
the
world
where you're from.
posso. Quando eu chamo o mundo inteiro pra jogar é pra mostrar que eu posso. Torcer, chorar, sorrir, gritar. Não importa o resultado, vamos trabalhar.
As Segun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi mentioned, that's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, titled We Are One. American singers Pitbull and Jennifer Lopez and Brazilian songstress Claudia Leite are scheduled to perform the song again June 12th at the World Cup's opening ceremony in Sao Paulo, just before the Brazil-Croatia match. The National Basketball Association playoffs resume later Monday night in Miami, Florida. The two-time defending champion Miami Heat hosts the Indiana Pacers in Game 4 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Miami leads the best-of-seven series 2-1. In Game 3 of the Western Conference Finals Sunday night, the Oklahoma City Thunder storm past the San Antonio Spurs 106-97. San Antonio now leads the series 2-1. Congolese power forward Serge Ibaka ignited the Thunder with 15 points and 4 block shots. Ibaka, nicknamed Air Congo, missed the first two games of the series with a calf injury, and it was thought he'd miss the rest of the playoffs. Air Congo back on the court. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. In our feature segment, we look into the conflict going on in South Sudan, which has prompted a humanitarian crisis. And next, the United Nations says the world's population will increase by 35% by the middle of the century. But first, some music. Here is Ivory Coast's Tikan Jafakole with African Revolution.
Go to school, my brother. I said, go to school. You will understand very soon all the problems of your nation.
We want a revolution. Young people, revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education.
In your mind, brother, there is the power to change the world. This understanding will help make a better place. And in your hands, brother,
There is the key to this continent. And if we don't unlock it soon, it will be lost to the government. Para feel oh, you know. Oluka tanya yine, nunu vanga jamana gouverneur anyami ma.
Ivory Coast, Tikanja Fakole with African Revolution. Celebrations that marked the birth of the world's youngest nation, South Sudan, were short-lived. The conflict in South Sudan between President Salva Kiir's government and the opposition led by his former deputy Riek Machar has prompted a humanitarian crisis. For some perspective on the situation, reporter Vincent Makore spoke with author James Copnell. He is the author of a book on South Sudan's independence from Sudan called A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts, Sudan and South Sudan's Bitter and Incomplete Divorce. Vincent asked Mr. Copnell to explain how he got the name for his book.
It's a quote actually from Omar al-Bashir's uncle, the Sudanese president's uncle, and he described the South Sudanese as a poisonous thorn in the hearts of Sudan. Now, that's not something a lot of Sudanese people would agree with, but I chose that title because it reflected a reality in the period after separation, after the 2011 split, when both countries tried essentially to antagonize the other, or at least the political leaderships did. So you had both countries were sponsoring rebel groups in the other country, there was economic warfare largely around oil, and even direct clashes on the disputed border. It was a difficult first couple of years after separation for both countries, and it showed how both countries were still intertwined despite the separation.
Would you say that from a person who spent some time there, the time was really ripe for this separation, to have countries that can function separately?
I would say yes. Look, there had been two very long north-south civil wars within Sudan in which millions of people had died. And the bottom line is 99% of South Sudanese voted for separation. The South Sudanese people wanted an independent country, and that's absolutely their right, and I think therefore it was the right decision. Now, this young country, South Sudan, has immense challenges, really, really difficult challenges. At independence, it was underdeveloped, it had faced the ravages of war for such a long period of time. It had also, of course, its generation of leaders were rebel leaders, people more used to fighting in the bush than running a country, and there have been political quarrels, and that's led to the terrible situation we see now.
Now, some would say, isn't that a basis for an argument that perhaps it wasn't time, that some of those who were going to take leadership hadn't even really gotten to a point where they can run a country? And also there's the other question of some things hadn't been clearly agreed upon on how to separate the spoils of the separation.
Well, look, let's take that one by one. Were the South Sudanese ready? Put it this way, in the 50 years or so since Sudan became independent in 1956 from the colonial powers, the South Sudanese had largely known warfare and underdevelopment and bad governance from Khartoum. Why should they not have their own go at running their own country? It's not as if the governance they'd had from Khartoum was any better. Now, should things have been agreed before? Undoubtedly. So what happened in the first couple of years after separation was disputes between Khartoum and Juba over oil, over the borders, over disputed regions like Abyei. And this led to huge problems for both countries because of economic interdependence of the two states, because of the way that people still live together. So in the book, A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts, I talk also about a South Sudanese doctor, Garang, who fell in love with a Northern Sudanese. They got married, they had children. And then when the separation came, he was in South Sudan, she was in Sudan with the children, and they needed visas to, to see the members of their family. Those ties are still there, but it could have been sorted out better before independence, but that doesn't mean the South Sudanese shouldn't have the country they dreamed of.
Now, very quickly, many people get a little suspicious of a Westerner writing a book or even reporting on Africa. There's always been, there have been these perceptions that there's always an agenda if it's all some guy from the West. What would you say in your defense?
Well, I challenge people to read the book and see to what extent those criticisms could be true. My concern in this book was to reflect the voices of Sudanese and South Sudanese politicians, but also ordinary people. So I profile cowherders and women who sell tea on the streets of Khartoum, and people who live in very remote places, and religious leaders, people from all parts of Sudanese and South Sudanese society, and attempt to bring their voice to readers in Sudan, in South Sudan, throughout Africa and the world.
That was author James Copnell speaking about South Sudan's struggle for independence from Sudan. He was speaking with reporter Vincent Makori. The United Nations says the world's population will increase by 35% by the middle of the century. Much of that growth is in Africa. Global foods production needs to meet that increase. A recent study of soybeans, a protein-rich food crop, may feed a hungry world. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
The whole length of the line.
The UN predicts food production must increase by 70% to meet the needs of a wealthier and more urban world population. The World Food Prize Foundation president Kenneth Quinn calls it the greatest challenge in history.
There's going to be another 2 billion people on our planet between now and 2050. And how are we going to produce enough food for them to eat?
One solution is through science, such as a new soybean study led by Darren Drury of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. With the help of a computer model, Drury is looking for a super soybean that can be more productive and reflects more light back into space to reduce the effects of global warming while using less water.
As climate change impacts the distribution of precipitation, both the magnitude and when it happens, we're finding that agricultural systems are in some cases becoming more and more stressed.
One plant with all these traits may be hard to find in the natural world, but with data from real soybean plants, a computer can redesign a plant with all the traits through the arrangement of the leaves, their density, and angle to the sun. The next step is to take the computer's model plant and test it in the field by artificially manipulating the plant. University of Illinois professor Stephen Long explains the process. He spoke via Skype.
One of the things the modeling has predicted is that there's too much leaf area. So we're actually removing leaves as the plant's growing to get a lower leaf area. We're also artificially modifying the angle of the leaves as well to reflect what the model predicted.
If the plants in the field behave as the computer model predicted, scientists will look for lines of soybean with specific traits and crossbreed them into the computer's super soybean. Long says the computer modeling can also apply to other major crops, such as wheat and rice, to help with the expected water shortage and global food crisis. The World Food Prize Foundation's Kenneth Quinn says the demand for food and water will impact the world beyond its fields and kitchens.
The potential for conflict and wars is increased significantly. And so national security and global food security are now becoming one and the same.
He says lawmakers, farmers, and scientists need to work together to prepare for the ever-growing thirst and appetite of the future. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Like many nations, the United States pauses each year to honor those who died in its defense through military service. The custom is an ancient one, recalling a speech by the Athenian statesman Pericles that the casualties of war are worthy men, and the living need not have a more heroic spirit. On Monday, March 26th, Memorial Day, in communities across America, there will be speeches striking similar themes, and a moment of silence will be observed. Like the poppies in Flanders Fields, small flags will be seen among the graves in the nation's many military cemeteries, and the families of the fallen will stop to remember. Beyond mere ceremony, the day represents a debt paid by the living to those Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice to ensure their country's freedom. Some died in battle, some of disease. Others were lost in foreign prisons and never returned. Most died very young, defending their nation's ideals and liberties, perhaps even before they had much of a chance to fully appreciate them. Hundreds of thousands died, fighting to make others free too, in North Africa, Europe, the Pacific, Asia, and the Middle East. Memorial Day honors no single battle or war. Its meaning transcends heroic monuments. Rather, it is the recognition by a grateful nation that lives and blood lost in defense of its freedoms are never given in vain.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. Also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
The Voice of America, VOA.